Welcome, friends, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Our guest today, Jim, is from my neck of the woods. She's right down the street. But you are not, sir. You are still back in New York.
I'm back in New York enjoying the fall until another couple of weeks, and I head out to sunny Arizona and escape all this.
Yeah, get out to my time zone. That's good. Well, our guest is Oriana Schuyler-Mastro. She is one of the world's leading experts on Chinese military and security issues, including, of course, here where I live, near Stanford University, where she is a resident fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute. Oriana is also a well-decorated reserve officer in the world's greatest Air Force, to which I generously donated 35 years of my life. And, of course, for you podcast trivia buffs, she is in a long-term contractual arrangement with our guest from episode 25, ours on Tara 4.
Okay.
An arrangement I believe routinely involves a high-level coordination of who's washing the dishes and picking up their two boys from school. Of particular interest for today's discussion, Oriana is the author of the recently released book, Upstart, How China Became a Great Power. So, Oriana, thanks for joining us, and let's start with our baseline question. Why should we care how China became a great power?
Well, that's a great way to start. And before I tell you why we should care, since you mentioned very graciously in my bio, my Air Force role, of course, I would be remiss still being a relatively low level officer if I did not say that the views that I am expressing are my own and do not represent those of the United States government, the United States Department of Defense, or the United States Air Force.
Well noted.
Especially as we get into some more controversial topics where anyone who knows anything about the U.S. military knows that maybe some of my views go against some of the conventional wisdom in the military. So why should we care about how China became a great power? There's sort of two big components that I talk about in the book. The one is to understand where we are in this competition, right? How do we understand power? How do we understand how it's built and exercised? I think it's not useful to think about underestimating or overestimating the Chinese threat. What I say is that we mischaracterize it. We miss a lot of stuff that they do that is extremely impactful and undermines US interests. And then we overfocus on some stuff that they do that actually doesn't have a big impact. So a big part of the book is to actually say, listen, there's all this research that says when people do things differently, you tend not to recognize it and you tend to underestimate it. So we need to be a bit more clever about how we understand what the Chinese are doing. We can't just be looking for overseas bases to see whether or not they're a military threat. In the book, for example, I put together a data set of all the police and law enforcement that they train around the world. China trains the vast majority of police forces in this world, right? Something that most people don't know. So to understand how they compete for power, that gives us a better picture of the great power competition and a better picture of maybe what the United States should do about it. And the second component, of course, this is a book about the past 30 years, how China has competed for power. But the framework I lay out, I think, gives us a really rigorous and useful way to understand what the next 30 years are going to look like. When is China's strategy going to change? In what case is it going to stay the same? And I'll just give one example. I think that there's a lot of people who assume as China gets more powerful, they will start acting more like the United States. They might start engaging more in foreign wars. They might build up their nuclear arsenal to be on par with that of the United States. There's a lot of areas where China hasn't emulated the United States that we think it's just a capabilities thing, right? If they could, they would. But what I explain in my book is there's a lot of reasons that the Chinese often do not act like the United States and pursue power in different ways. And so some of the arguments they put forth are, yes, this is a great idea. It works for the United States. Once we become more powerful, we want to do it too. And then there's some cases where they think, you know, U.S. strategy is not so great. And so we can predict that in the future, those areas where they think U.S. strategy is not effective, they're not going to go down that path. While other areas that are more capabilities-based, they might.
So, Oriana, it's really a fascinating story. And the fact that China's had such amazing success in just 30 years is historic. Was this a plan, you think, from the very beginning under Deng and then Xi followed through? Or this sort of iterative that they kept seeing opportunities and going for it?
I think it's the latter. So it is a bigger plan in that China did make a deliberate decision to build power and wanted to become a great power, right? So there's a lot of countries that have economic power that don't build militaries. Or there's countries like North Korea that, you know, build this big military but don't have economic power. In the book, I lay out a lot of the Chinese discourse on this issue. They made a very deliberate decision. Xi Jinping is at the end of that, but he's not the first to say they wanted to be a great power, right? And so that part of it is deliberate. What is interesting in what I talk about in the book is how to do that. And that is much more iterative. It's kind of like experimentation. Does this work? How do we flex this way, flex that way? Let's change it up to try to just get to that end goal of having, you know, more strategic space.
So you talk about your three E's, as it were, right? So the idea that there are some things that they're going to do that emulate us, that E1 is emulate, and they're trying to emulate what we do. And that's not really sort of the focus of the book. It's just sort of nodding to the fact that, yes, there are going to be some things that we recognize. And so, you know, they have aircraft carriers, not very good ones, not very mature ones, but there are aircraft carriers. There are some things that they do that exploit the gaps in what we're doing. And so we're doing a lot of this diplomacy, but they're going to do a lot more diplomacy in places that we're ignoring, for example. And then finally, the final one is the entrepreneurship. And you talked about the training of the police forces or whatever, you know, or maybe that's not the best example, but, you know, things that they do that are just kind of outside our experience altogether. We never thought of them. They're the upstart. That's the whole theme of the book, right? So maybe talk about why it's so important for people to understand that framework when they're trying to understand China.
Well, I think it's, you know, for political scientists, and this does happen in policy as well, people do the mirror imaging, and there's the assumption always that China is going to act like the United States. So political scientists have this idea that to become a great power, you emulate great power successes. And so that was the conventional wisdom that I was building on. And I was saying, listen, there's a lot of reasons why that doesn't make a lot of sense for a country like China. The international system is different now than it was during the US rise. China has different competitive advantages. They also have some weaknesses, right? Maintaining Communist Party control is really crucial to some of the decisions they make. And they have to make sure that the United States doesn't respond in a negative way during this rise to kind of squash them early on. And so because of that, this explanation of just emulation was insufficient. And so originally when I started the book, and you mentioned it, the entrepreneurship is the most interesting to me when they do something completely different. When they, for example, you know, Belt and Road is kind of a different way of doing development. I'm reluctant to call it development assistance because it's not really development assistance. It's more, you know, co-opting elites. But that's how they do it. Or their industrial policy to promote innovation versus laissez-faire. Or how they don't have alliances, they have strategic partnerships instead. You know, there are things that they do different. And so originally when I started this piece, it was based on, I wrote this piece for Foreign Affairs in 2019, where I put forth this idea that China does things different. And I started writing a book that said China just does everything different. But as you pointed out, like, that's not true. I mean, they have a navy, they still have diplomats. So it built on it to say, okay, when do they emulate? What are the conditions under which they emulate the United States? When are they entrepreneurial? So they have a whole new strategy. And then the exploitation component is when they adopt the U.S. strategy, but as you mentioned, in new areas of competition where the United States isn't present. So in addition to kind of categorizing Chinese strategies, I trace through some of the Chinese debates to pinpoint exactly why, in that case, they chose, you know, emulation, exploitation, or entrepreneurship.
So were they so successful at this because they are China, they're big, they're authoritarian, they're able to do these things? I don't see other countries being able to achieve this sort of success, even if they follow your blueprint.
Well, most other countries don't follow that blueprint. I mean, I think one of the key things is that rising powers face different incentives. By definition, as a rising power, they have to catch up. So there is a hyper focus on things like efficiency and effectiveness. They have to worry about the great power response. When China in the 90s, 2000s was doing, you know, was taking some sort of action, they would ask themselves, is this reassuring to the United States or threatening to the United States? Most other countries don't have to worry to that degree if they're not in the rising power category. And because they don't have to catch up, you know, emulation makes a lot of sense, right? You still get a lot of gains through emulation. So most countries, that's what they're doing, is doing a more, you know, looking at other countries and figuring out what's successful and then doing it themselves. They don't have the same pressure of a rising power. Now, you asked me, you sort of mentioned the autocratic in nature. And so I have to be clear. The book does not say, and I'm not arguing that China is successful at this because they're an autocratic country. But what they do better than we do in the United States is they take into account how their domestic political system creates disadvantages for them and advantages for them. And then they're very good at selecting areas of competition where they have the advantage. Right? So areas of competition where maybe democracies would have the advantage, China just doesn't compete. While in the United States, we just try to do everything. We're not like, maybe if this isn't, state-directed approach in this area would be better. That's not really our jam. So let's not do it, right? We come out, we try to compete with BRI, with our own, like, Build Back Better and stuff. So China is better at assessing where they're weak, where they're strong, and then catering to that. And then the last thing I want to say is this isn't a book about some sort of specific thing to Chinese culture. The book is about China, so I didn't have time to go through the history of other rising powers. But I would posit that if you look at U.S. history, for example, you know, who has been more entrepreneurial about power than the United States, right? The United States, during its rise, started international institutions. You know, instead of having a colonial empire, built this like global power projection network, invented basically soft power, a whole new form of power, of which the United States is still number one in every possible category, despite, you know, China's attempts to unseat us. So I think generally speaking, if I had to posit a hypothesis, though I didn't actually prove this in the book, I think the successful rising powers, they all pursue this type of upstart strategy. And it's the ones that emulate too much that end up failing.
So you mentioned soft power, and I guess one of the interesting things about soft power, of course, is so much of it is something we never decided to do. We just kind of do what we do, and it works, right? You know, or capitalism. You know, it's not we didn't go out to decide to be capitalists one day. It's just that's our system, and that's what we do, and it works to do certain things. So, to what extent do we need to adapt these things? Do we need to emulate and exploit and, you know, or be entrepreneurial, or, and to what extent do we just need to keep doing what we do best and hope that over time that's going to win out?
Yeah. So I think it really depends on the issue area. So there are some areas where China has been very effective at building power. So, you know, selling of AI surveillance equipment, for example, or I mentioned the training of the police forces. Those are things that we don't want them to be doing, that is bad for the international system, or maybe debt trap diplomacy type of things. We're not going to compete with them in those areas. Regime agnosticism, how they support, you know, they don't care about the regime, and the result of that is supporting a lot of autocracies around the world. We're not going to compete with them in supporting autocracy around the world, right? So we don't want to emulate that. That's a really key category for blunting, right? And Rush Doshi talks about this a bit in his book about China basically trying to blunt the effectiveness of U.S. strategies. If it's an area where we don't want to compete, but China's effective, then we should go for blunting. If it's an area where China's doing something new, but we have certain competitive advantages and we say, hey, we haven't thought about it, but now that you've brought that up, we would be awesome at that, you know, then sure, emulate. But the problem is right now what the United States is doing is they're just looking at what China does and they're like, we need to do all these things. So there's a lot of discussion like, oh, they have this industrial policy to promote innovation. Do we need an industrial policy? It's like, no, as you mentioned, laissez-faire approaches are actually, you know, what works better for us. And so there's a concept in the business literature called position straddling. And a lot of these arguments kind of come from the business management literature. Position straddling is when a company is faced with a competitor and they decide to do exactly like, let me do that thing my competitor is doing, but maintain everything also that I do. So this is like the United Airlines faced with Southwest just decides to charge for baggage. And it's the worst of all scenarios, right? You're not a budget airline, so you're not as good as Southwest in that category of, you know, customers that want the budget airlines. And then you have this client base that, expect a certain level of service, and now I can't get food on my flight, you know? So this happens a lot, and this can be the downfall of companies as they're trying to compete with upstarts. And so if, you know, I often advise that if anything, we should be very wary of emulating, because that allows China to decide the areas we're competing. And of course, they're going to choose areas where maybe they have those advantages.
Okay. So what is the end state that China is going for? Is it to replace the U.S. in Asia as the hegemon? Is it beyond that? And also, are we looking at a Thucydides trap type scenario where we are going to push back somehow more forcefully if at some future date?
So let me just say that I have a problem with the overall Thucydides trap framework for understanding U.S.-China relations. For your extra nerdy listeners, I had a whole article on this that I went through, like, you know, Graham Allison's, I don't know, 8 components of the Thucydides trap. And just one by one, I was like, none of these variables are relevant to the U.S.-China relationship. So, like, you know, even like nuclear, like, oh, mutually assured destruction. Well, we don't have it. So, like, why are we even talking about it with China? And that kind of rationale assumes like misunderstanding and misperceptions. And that's not my understanding of what's happening between China and the United States right now. I think we understand each other very clearly. We just don't like what we understand, which is, you know, China wants strategic space. I get that. I understand that. If I were China, I would be doing exactly what China is doing, right? They are a growing power. They don't want the United States constantly on top of them about stuff. They don't want to be surrounded by the U.S. military. They feel like they have these rightful claims, territorial claims, what have you, in the international system. And the only thing standing in the way is the United States that just like, you know, from the Chinese perspective, they're like, why do you care, United States? Like, get out of my way and everything would be peaceful. You know, when I talk to my Chinese counterparts, they say all the time, like, the reason there are problems is because the United States is in Asia. So to your question, do they want the United States military out of Asia? Absolutely. Anyone who says otherwise is insane. Like when people say, no, but of course, and like China understands, like, you know, that we promote free trade. I'm like, they want to do it themselves. They feel like they can do it themselves. They don't want the United States there. So they don't want it. They don't want the United States to have that coercive power over them. And so when they say to me, if the United States wasn't there, we'd have peace and stability. And I say, yeah, you're right. And you're right, because if the United States wasn't there, countries would be forced to capitulate to Chinese bullying, right? And that's what China means when they say that we're the number one problem. Now, I sort of follow that, you're right, up with the like, yeah, but that's not really how we do things anymore. Like, the United States is not going to go away so you can, like, you know, coerce all your neighbors to kowtow to you. So I guess it's going to be a problem for a while. But China, you know, wants to be the dominant power in Asia. And, you know, they want to have influence globally, but I think they're mainly wanting to rely on political and economic power outside of Asia to protect their goals.
Well, since we're talking about trying to understand China and how China reacts to things, I want to turn back the clock a little bit to about this time last year, when you had just returned from a trip to Beijing and came back and wrote an article for the New York Times, essentially saying that we are not getting China, essentially, and that what we are doing is essentially talking too much about Taiwan and maybe doing too little. Is that a fair way to kind of set up that, you know, what we were trying to get across in that piece?
Yeah, I think that is a bit more balanced and fair than maybe the critics of that piece would have posited. So, you know, I like to say that I have something for everybody to hate. You know, I have some pieces on Taiwan, which people are like, oh, you know, Oriana, she's so hawkish. And then some pieces, that one in particular, that people on the right were like, you've been co-opted by the Communist Party. I mean, this is the thing about being an academic. And for me, this issue is too important. Everything's issue specific. Like, if it's based on facts, I don't have a blanket opinion, like, about everything that then I can take some overarching, like, you know, general thought and then form opinions about all these specific issues based on it. It really depends on the issue at hand. So in that piece, what I was arguing, it was very clearly, listen, in other pieces I've written, I'm all for U.S. military buildup in Asia. It is absolutely critical. Our capability to defend Taiwan is questionable at best, and that encourages aggression, right? People are always like, China doesn't want to fight a war with the United States. And I'm like, agreed. But if they can take Taiwan in 2.5 to 3 weeks, they're not going to have to fight the United States. That's the scenario that I'm worried about. So if we build up our military capabilities close to Taiwan, so that's, you know, Southwest Islands in Japan, Northern Philippines, that's so critical to peace and stability. So on one hand, you look at that and you're like, wow, Oriana's real hawk. I'm just like, give me all the, you know, give me all the guns. You know, I want to put them there. Specifically, what I want is intermediate range ballistic missiles, land-based, and more submarines. But, you know, generally speaking, all the guns, all the bombs, I want them there. But we have to be clear, like, U.S. policy on Taiwan is not to keep Taiwan from China, right? U.S. policy is that China cannot take Taiwan by force. And there have been developments in the United States, for example, when we talk about our interests in Taiwan. Like, Taiwan has a semiconductor industry that's so important. We don't want it to fall in the hands of China. That rationale suggests that we don't want Taiwan to be a part of China regardless of how it happens. Now, this might just seem like an intellectual point because the people of Taiwan don't want to be a part of China. But the reason it's important is if we can get force posture right and we can put the military in the right places with the right stuff, if Xi Jinping is considering that war of choice, like, oh, I probably could take Taiwan. Do I want to take Taiwan? You know, we can deter that. But if our policy and what we're saying and doing suggests that we've changed our mind and we're trying to keep Taiwan from China, the threshold of the military power that we need to deter that use of force might be higher than at least what I can conceptually cobble together, right? And so it's interesting because people think military stuff is aggressive and hawkish and provocative, but Taiwan's a political issue. And when I talk to the Chinese, they get much more upset about the political stuff than they do the military stuff. So people who want to, like, you know, put the brakes on this Taiwan thing, they say, don't do military exercises around Taiwan, just support Taiwan politically. And that's like the worst thing you could do. So that's why I argued, like, Congress, like, stop going to Taiwan. Like, you know, President Biden, stop, you know, randomly making statements about how Taiwan is an ally and you're going to defend Taiwan. None of that improves deterrence. None of it improves our operational position. And all it does is convince the Chinese that maybe at a lower likelihood of victory, it's worth going for.
So just to be clear, so when our politicians like to go and stop and visit Taiwan and wave our flag, that's waving a red flag to the Chinese. But our politicians believe it's showing support for Taiwan's continued, we won't call it sovereignty, but situation. How do we demonstrate that support without any sort of political backing?
So I think this goes to what you think deters China. China assumes worst case scenario planning. They assume that the United States is going to try to intervene, right? The question at that point is, like, if we will. So when our politicians go and they make speeches and they're like, oh, I'm going to defend Taiwan, the view in Beijing is like, okay, you say you want to, but can you? And then even intervention, the main thing about resolve that's unknown about the United States is not whether or not we'll defend Taiwan. It's at what cost. So we use resolve as this overarching term, but resolve can mean two things, right? It can mean your willingness to fight at all and your willingness to absorb costs over time. So when we make statements about that, we're really, you know, trying to hit at the willingness to fight at all, which is not something that is a key component in determining, like, China's thinking, unless we very clearly are like, we don't care, Taiwan is yours. Otherwise, they have to assume we're going to do something. But when we make those statements, it doesn't tell them anything about our willingness to absorb costs over time, right? Everyone still thinks, okay, yeah, United States, you say you want to defend Taiwan. One, do you have the capabilities? Two, even if you have the capabilities, how long are you going to do that for? Those things are still unknowns, and nothing about those policies help. And I think, you know, one of the things that does hurt operationally is that the United States requires, you know, ABO, access basing and overflight, in other countries to defend Taiwan. And if it looks like we instigated this in any way, and to a lot of countries, you know, China did those big exercises after Nancy Pelosi's visit. Everyone called them like the post-Pelosi exercises. China had planned those for months before. Nancy Pelosi had nothing to do with it. But they get this, like, the Chinese then get this pass because the United States is being provocative. So I worry, not in a sort of touchy-feely legitimacy way, like I just want everyone to like us type of way, but if it looks like we caused this, I think it's going to limit our military options in the defense of Taiwan, which is another reason that I was like, just speak softly and carry a big stick. because the speaking loudly and not carrying a stick situation is like the worst of all the options.
All right. Well, so for the Bulmos party, let's turn to the South China Sea, because you had another pretty important article this past summer where you essentially said that we need to be calling China's bluff in the South China Sea. And obviously, it's been a very sporty couple of years here with regard to our ally, the Philippines. And actually, we can kind of pull back in some of the themes from your book, because one of the ways in which China's been entrepreneurial has been the buildup of this huge paramilitary force, which is the way in which it's enforcing its will in the Philippines' exclusive economic zone against its other neighbors, not using its navy. So how is it that we should, again, according to your thesis, how should we approach this problem of South China Sea coercion, this expanding presence, this huge paramilitary force, Coast Guard, maritime militia, and you know, what can we do to try to stem or even reverse the tide?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought up that article, because I think it really does highlight the importance of having a deep understanding of these issues, right? I stay up at night like worried once China's ready, they're going to take Taiwan by force. That doesn't mean that I worry about South China Sea. I mean, anyone who studies military operations can tell that, you know, they're different. They're different conflicts. And so just because we have challenges in one area doesn't mean we'd have challenges in another area. And in the South China Sea, it's the size of half the continental United States. China cannot project power over those distances right now. And it's not just my expert opinion on it, because what I think doesn't matter. When you're trying to understand Chinese behavior, it's what they believe that matters. But in my discussions with the PLA and with Chinese colleagues, like, they would absolutely say, we have the advantage in Taiwan, you still have the advantage in the South China Sea. So this is one area, you know, if things escalated over Taiwan, China might go for it. But in the South China Sea, they're not going to start a war with the United States that they're going to lose. And that's why we have this opportunity to call their bluff. So a lot of these gray zone activities you're referring to, they create dangerous conditions for the United States to operate. And then we are fearful that because of those dangerous conditions, if there's some sort of accident and loss of life, things will escalate. You know, I always do these magic fingers, because it's like, you know, how nobody talks about, like, we're fighting a war we don't want to fight. And it's like, well, how did that, if we don't want to fight it, why are we fighting it? You know, the Chinese don't believe an inadvertent escalation. And they kind of have a point. Like, they would just back down in that scenario. So this is really the time to say, no, China, we're not going to let you bully the Philippines, whatever. And in terms of the specifics operational, I think I mentioned a few things in the New York Times op-ed about, you know, the United States conducting patrols or escorts of the Philippines. But, you know, one of the great things I would say about being a professor and also being in the military is, you know, my access to some of that operational knowledge. I always say, to be an expert, you don't have to know everything yourself. You just have to know people who know everything. And so to get to the details, right, you're going to have to wait just a little while longer, because I'm in the process of writing an article with a colleague of mine who's in the Coast Guard, who knows all those operational details of, like, exactly what could be done. Like, we had this whole conversation about, like, boarding procedures and, you know, the ways in which, you know, it's hard or not hard or whatever to deal with some of these paramilitary forces. So what does that pushing back look like? I mean, Nick Frieden is his name, the Coast Guard gentleman that I'm writing this with. He wrote a piece in Proceedings in which he talked a little bit about it, not for the South China Sea, but we're going to kind of delve in to see if we can come up with some recommendations for this particular scenario.
So Ariana, have you talked to people in Southeast Asia, especially Malaysia and Indonesia? Because they'd be horrified by what you said. Yeah. Philippines is an exception. Have you tried talking to them about this and getting their reaction?
Yeah, so I try to explain. There's many things. You know, I was in Indonesia earlier this year, and I'm not a Southeast Asia expert. Like, let me be clear. I don't speak any of those languages. But one thing that really stands out to me about Southeast Asia, you know, I once did this experiment, because I go to Singapore every year, I go to Vietnam every once in a while. I always ask them this hypothetical South China Sea question, which is, imagine that we're going to fight a war in the South China Sea and the United States is 100% going to win. Okay, so there's no uncertainty. The United States is going to win. will you support the United States in this war? And I still get from a lot of people, no. And why is the answer no? I'm like, we'll give you all the, you know, like you win, you get the spoils of war. The answer is still like the costs of war with China in their mind are so high, you know, that even being victorious is problematic, right? This is what's difficult about U.S. policy in the South China Sea. We have attached, we kind of pretend we don't have interests in the South China Sea. Like that's, we have been working through allies and partners. We're like, this isn't about us. This is about you. And one part, you know, that enhances our legitimacy in being an actor there. But on the other hand, the United States can't protect its allies and partners, its economic interests, unless we have freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. I think we need to be more honest about some of those more self-serving goals that we have there. So you're absolutely right. Like, how does Indonesia and Malaysia feel about this? Like, you know, no, they're not going to be supportive of it. Even the Filipino government, you know, the idea of the United States taking a more aggressive lead is, you know, I had this line in the New York Times piece based on some feedback I got from people in the administration of like, listen, that's not what our ally wants. Like they want to look like they're in the lead. And so I'm like, well, I think there's ways we could still do that. So we do have to take into account all those things. But I think we have to be honest that this isn't just about them. Like even if Indonesia and Malaysia decided that they wanted to capitulate to China and give up a great deal of their sovereignty to China, because then China gets to decide, you know, whether or not they get to trade on any given day, that's still not okay for us in the United States.
So you talked about how they, I think you're specifically referring to the PLA Navy and Air Force, that they are not yet able to project power down into the South China Sea and a lot of these places, but their paramilitary forces are able to project power at least sufficient to what they're trying to get done, which is to coerce their neighbors, right? So, you know, we've now seen this expansion of their presence in the West Philippine Sea, in part because they have this these big island bases. They have a much larger maritime militia than they had before. They have a much larger Coast Guard, and they are not afraid to use it. And so it seems like, you know, back to this idea of being entrepreneurial, they are exploiting this space that we have no response to because we don't do paramilitary forces. You know, it's just not in our bailiwick. And so, you know, is the only response we have ultimately to go back to a military solution, or do we have anything else in the toolkit we could pull out?
So I do talk about those gray zone activities extensively in the book, and I do put forth as an entrepreneurial approach, because whether something's entrepreneurial is in reference to the United States. You know, China's not the only country that does gray zone, but the United States, as you mentioned, doesn't really do that well. This is another difference. Like they can achieve their goals in the South China Sea without using force, right? If they just keep on doing what they're doing, like their presence is there and other countries just concede to their presence, like they win. That's very different than Taiwan, in which you're not going to have full control of the island unless, you know, there's going to be some significant use of force. So the way that you have to push back on China is to make it so that they can't operate in the way that they want to everywhere. And how do we do that? We really have to start thinking outside of the box on some of these things. I mean, first and foremost, it's my understanding, for example, our alliance agreements do not cover exclusive economic zones, right? So we're not required actually to defend any of these areas that are currently being contested between, you know, China and other countries. It's only when they come within 12 nautical miles of a certain feature that like we come into play, you know. Our value as an ally, we have to rethink, like, what is our value as an ally? A lot of countries are not concerned about physical occupation by China, right? Is China going to invade Australia tomorrow? Is China going to be marching to Tokyo? But that doesn't mean China's not a threat, because China has determined that they can control the policies and future of a country without physically occupying them, right? So it's the same end state of a loss of sovereignty. It's just a different method. So how do we push back against that? Maybe rethink, you know, what our alliance agreements cover. Rethink the conditions under which we have coordinated responses. that's not just you have physically attacked me and you are invading me, but something like, you know, these gray zone activities. It's also very weird. I don't know if you remember, but for like 10 years, and this is what I was talking about the Coast Guard too, like we were so obsessed with like, we have to do exactly what China does, that we were like, well, China uses like, you know, Coast Guard or maritime militia, so we can't respond unless we have a maritime militia, which didn't make any sense. You're just kind of like, no, just respond with the Navy. And people were worried that was escalatory, but I often advise that I think for proportionality, we need to focus on outcomes, not the process, right? So it's something like, if China messes with our satellites so we lose communication, the proportionate response is not to mess with Chinese satellites. This is a hypothetical war scenario. It's to mess with whatever they use to communicate. It would be proportionate to mess, you know, mess with ground stations in China in charge of communication if the end goal is the same. We lost communications, you lost communications. If we think of proportionality in terms of the action, you know, China always wins.
So getting back to our Southeast Asian friends, what Ray and I have heard over the years repeatedly was, don't make us choose. We don't want to choose. We don't have to choose. We're friends with both of you, economically reliant on China more than you. What do you think our policy should be? Or what should the United States say to them in response to that?
So what I say is they've chosen, because China wants neutrality. And so when countries choose neutrality, they have chosen China. Like that's just the reality of it. And that's understandable. For a lot of countries, it's understandable. I mean, the United States, what we want from our allies, we want their active participation. China just wants them to do nothing. And then if there is a conflict and you're on the wrong side of the conflict, what is the United States going to do if we win? I mean, we'll forgive you, we'll move on. What is China going to do if they win and you are on the other side? Like, they will not forget it for thousands of years. Like, so I get the logic of why Southeast Asian countries are like, okay, United States, like, I like you and everything, but I don't want to choose, which again is just doing what China wants them to do. And what I say is, the reality is every country has a different level of tolerance to loss of sovereignty. The United States is a big country. We're very powerful. So we're not used to other countries telling us what to do. But every other country in the world has to consider, for the most part, some other countries. Like, what is the United States going to think about this? What is China going to think about this? What's Russia going to think about it? So in many cases, it seems like most other countries don't have full sovereignty over their choices. The question is, how comfortable are you with, you know, that loss of sovereignty? It's a different loss. If you're friends with the United States, are we going to ask you to do some things you don't want to do? Probably, right? But what is the degree of loss of sovereignty there versus if China is in control? So as long as there's an understanding of that, like, you know, I get it. If a country in Southeast Asia is like, I understand that, you know, I am at the whim of the Chinese and I prefer that outcome than you know, being conflictual with the Chinese to try to maintain my strategic space, I'm like, I get it. I got you. But I don't want them to be naive to think, one, this comes up a lot with the Indians, not with the Southeast Asians. The Indians are always like, we don't want to support you, America, in anything, but surely you'll defend us if China attacks us. I'm like, that's not really how it works, India, right? You can't have your cake and eat it too. And two, like, then don't be surprised when that happens, you know, and China is like, oh, you said something we didn't like, you know, there was a map in a movie you made that was bad. Like, now we're not buying your bananas anymore. Like, that is the world you're creating for yourself. So I think the United States, what we say to countries in Southeast Asia, I think the right message is, we want you to be sovereign and we want you to choose what is best for you. I just want to make sure that those countries understand the costs and benefits of all those choices before they make that decision.
Well, Oriana, the book is Upstart, How China Became a Great Power, now available from Oxford University Press. But how else should people be following Oriana Schuyler Mastro?
Well, I will say that my website always has all the media and podcasts and commentary. That's just OrianaSchuylerMastro.com. I would say, like, I'm on social media, on Twitter at OS Mastro. I'm not very good at social media, I have to say. it's hard to feel like everyone needs to hear my thoughts about everything. But, you know, every once in a while, I like, you know, I share, you know, podcasts and things like this that I do. So at the very least, you can see what I'm up to there.
Well, hopefully we will be prominently featured on your website when this goes up in a couple of weeks. So thank you again for joining us. It's good to see you. Hopefully I'll see you around campus when you're not jetting off to various capitals nationally and internationally. And thanks for coming. Well, Jim, Oriana is never boring. She has definite opinions on things, and she's not afraid to put them out there, which makes for great content.
It does. And also shows, you know, trying to pigeonhole people who are thoughtful is a mug's game. You know, she said, yeah. Hawk, dove. No, she's trying to get to what works, what the facts are, which is, of course, what you and I do every time we do these, Ray.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I think it is really helpful to sort of look at China and try to look at its national power and not look at it through, you know, our usual American or even Western sort of matrix, because we're going to miss a lot. And I think that's one thing that her book is really useful at pointing out.
Yeah. Well, and her point that these China's feel surrounded and hemmed in by U.S. military and other assets is something we may not agree with, but we should appreciate the Chinese point of view. I wish there was a way to go through that with the Chinese and find a way through.
Yeah. So I'm going to be at a dialogue in Manila early next month where there will be some Chinese representation. And so that should be an interesting opportunity to see, because it's a dialogue on the South China Sea. So it should be an interesting opportunity to see how those two worldviews collide when they're stuck into the same room and have to talk to each other, at each other, past each other. And yeah, I mean, to some degree, as Oriana pointed out, I mean, in the end, part of the problem is we just want very different things. And so, and you know, when it comes down to a question of should the U.S. military be in Asia or should it not be in Asia, we're not going to be able to reconcile that anytime soon, because they have one very different view on it than we do. And, you know, that's not going to be something we can just sort of negotiate away.
It's an interesting question that she sort of put out there. If we need to be more clear about our own interests rather than making it about the interests of our friends and neighbors out there.
Well, I think that's really important, Jim, because I have this conversation quite a bit when I'm in Asia, and I begin with just the simple fact that the U.S. has national interests, like every country has national interests, and any country that's not acting in its national interests is doing wrong by its people, right? So the U.S. is going to do what's in its interest. So, you know, we can't go out there and say, we're here because we like you so much, and we want what's best for you, you know, regardless of our national interest. That would be crazy. No country would do that. And so we can't, you know, put the Superman cape on and pretend that we're a superhero and we're out there to save everybody, because that's not what the American people want their government to do. So I think it does. I mean, we don't need to infantilize other countries and pretend that somehow our national interests don't matter in these conversations.
Right. What it should be about is an alignment of national interests, ours and theirs.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that, you know, when we talk about values, that, you know, it's you can't really pull apart in a lot of cases, values and interests. You know, things that we are interested in are the things that we value. So, but anyway, we're at time, and I think that this is your turn. Where were you? There I was, Jim. Where were you?
I was
in this week's story.
It was a dark and stormy night, Ray. This is a while ago. This is Indonesia around 2012, 2013. And we were working with an American company negotiating with the government of Indonesia to do offshore oil drilling or exploration in the Natuna Sea, north of Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And our interests were not just to help an American company. It was because even then we were aware of the 9-dash line and thought that laying a sort of physical claim to some of this area would be useful and would be help Indonesia as well to say, hey, look, we have these assets already operating. And we made this argument repeatedly to senior Indonesian officials, but they had other interests. It wasn't about kowtowing to China. It was about wanting to benefit their national oil company or extract more income from the U.S. But we were so focused on the geopolitical aspects that just had no resonance, at least at that time. So it makes me think over and over again, when the U.S. goes in with these big geostrategic ideas, sometimes our interlocutors just aren't looking at the world the same way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, where you stand is where you sit, right? You know,
I'm sitting in a cold room in upstate New York. So,
yeah. Well, when not one with not very good internet connectivity today. If you peek behind the curtain, today's been a little sporty on the production side. In fact, as we say, we want to, as always, thank Ian for making us look better than we deserve. And overcoming all these internet connectivity issues that we have from time to time. And also, of course, by putting out the really high quality products that he's been putting out. Please follow him at Ian Ellis Jones on X. And of course, please follow us on YouTube if that's how you get this content. We are youtube.com/IP Podcast. And there you can go, and you can go see the aforementioned episode 25 with Arzan Tarapur. Why should we care if India is deprioritizing its Navy? You can also look at for us on social media. Just look for Why Should We Care on LinkedIn and X. Why should we care about the Indo-Pacific? Of course, if you prefer audio podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, we do them all. So go ahead and look for us there. And we want to thank you for tuning in, recommending us to your friends, giving us those great reviews, and joining us next time on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?